Welcome to the SMA News Today podcast. I'm your host, Kevin Schaefer. I have SMA Type 2, and I am a columnist and forums director for SMANewsToday.com. Welcome to the SMA News Today podcast, episode 82. I'm your host, Kevin Schaefer. And joining me today is actually a fellow writer at our parent company, BioNews. Hawken Miller is a feature writer for BioNews and also a columnist for our sibling site, Muscular Dystrophy News Today. He lives in Newport Beach, California, and really excited to talk with him today. So, Hawken, thanks for joining me today.
Yeah, of course. Thanks for having me, Kevin.
Absolutely. I think this will be a really cool conversation. And I know you get to write both about your experiences living with MD, and also you do a ton of feature stories about people with SMA and many of the other diseases that BioNews covers. So if you are a reader of our site, you've probably come across Hawken's stories before, so this will be really cool. Well, before we get started, if everyone could please listen to a brief word from our sponsor.
This podcast was brought to you by Genentech, the makers of an FDA-approved treatment for SMA. To learn about our study results across different types of people with SMA, visit approvedforsma.com. That's approvedforsma.com.
Okay. Well, Hawken, to start off, can you just tell a little bit about your story? Like I said, people may know the articles you've written on SMA News Today, but they're usually features of other people. So if you can just give listeners a little bit about yourself, growing up with MD, anything you want to talk about there?
Sure. So I was born in Newport Beach, so I haven't gone very far, back in 1997, so I'm 24. And I was diagnosed with Duchenne muscular dystrophy when I was about 5.5. Don't have a ton of memory about that because it was so long ago now, but I do remember that my parents had seen I wasn't keeping up with other kids on like the AYSO soccer team, and they knew something was wrong, and we had our own diagnostic odyssey, like many other people I've covered have, about fighting with doctors being like, hey, he needs this calcium CK scan, blood test. I don't know the specifics, but something along those lines. And
sure.
It was creatine kinase, I believe is the test. So they did that. The doctors were hesitant to do it. Came back, you know, at a high level, which is an indication of Duchenne. And, you know, they had also seen, you know, my enlarged calves and the way, and my gait was a bit different. And so it all kind of pointed back to that. And obviously it was a tough diagnosis, but I think for me, it was in a way, it gave me more peace knowing that I wasn't doing anything wrong. It was just a malfunction in my gene and I had no control over it. And again, it wasn't my fault. And, you know, my parents very clear from the beginning were like, yeah, obviously you're not going to be a football player or a soccer player or something, but there's a lot you can do. And they talked about maybe you could be a writer, maybe you could be a musician or something. And so one of those ended up panning out. And so that's kind of my diagnosis story. And then, you know, from there, Duchenne, again, is very variable depending on the person. And my genetic mutation has to do with exon 45, I believe. So like saying that is variable, and it is a progressive disease as well. So I didn't necessarily, I wasn't in a wheelchair from early childhood. Like I would use a scooter to get around. I had this blue scooter that I would use, you know, throughout elementary school, middle school, high school. And, you know, I could walk around, I could, you know, play goalie or something like that, do activities that weren't super strenuous. And, you know, I could do a lot, but my parents were very strict about making sure I don't go upstairs, don't do any like a strenuous muscle exercise, just to keep my muscles as strong and lasting as long as possible. So one funny story from that is that my parents actually brought board games for the kids to play during recess, and thinking that I would, you know, do that and it would be a good way for me to be involved without being too active. But I didn't end up doing that. I always wanted to still play on the playground because I still could. So it's always a balance, I think, telling your kid you had to take it easy, but also knowing that like he wants to be a kid and run around. So that was kind of my early childhood. And then it wasn't until high school that, or eighth grade, that I kind of found writing might be something that I could do. I wrote an essay based off of the This I Believe book, which is a compilation of essays from a lot of famous people like Bill Gates, et cetera, on their worldview. And so I wrote one about myself, talked about my faith, how God sees me for who I am, no matter what my situation is, no matter what I look like, no matter what my situation is. And so I had to read that in front of class, and I ended up like crying, started crying halfway through. And so I had a friend finish it for me, but I think it just showed me like the power of writing and the stories that we can tell, the stories I could tell. And so in high school, you know, I couldn't do a lot of the sports things. I was involved with the football team as far as taking stats and helping like manage the team, et cetera. But the group that I was really able to find common ground with this was with the publications group at my high school, Sage Hill. And that included the yearbook and newspaper. And my ninth grade English teacher thought it would be great for me to be involved in that, to focus on writing, not physical activity, and to be able to, you know, connect with people that way. And so, you know, a couple years later, I ended up becoming editor in chief of the newspaper. And then everything just kind of kept going towards journalism, and I hadn't looked back since then. So I worked for the Daily Trojan, the media center, the Annenberg Media Center at USC, and then KTLA, Sacramento Bee, Washington Post, and now I'm with BioNews. So it kind of all seemed to have happened pretty quickly, but I found writing was something that I could do. I like to tell myself to focus on the things I can do, not what I can't do. And writing was one of those things. Photography was one of those things. Can't really do that too much anymore because cameras are heavy. But I think that's always kind of been my mantra, and that's how I got into journalism and how I got to where I am today.
That's really cool. Yeah, no, it's amazing. It's a similar journey for me. I didn't know I wanted to do journalism really until college, but the writing was there from an early age as well. And one thing I'm curious about too, so Lina, I know your diagnosis came a little bit later, and you said you didn't start using a wheelchair till later. How old were you when you did transition to a chair, and what was that process like? Because I know it is something that, I mean, other SMAers experience. It's not, I mean, I've been in a chair since I was 2, but there are others with like type 3 that don't start using a chair till later. So I was curious what that transition was like for you.
Yeah, it's interesting. I'm grateful that I was able to grow up without that. I was able to, you know, still keep up with my friends and such. And maybe that, in a sense, protected me from bullying. But I think another thing I'll bring up real fast is that my parents, like, talked to all the other parents at our school about my condition. They said, you know, he's not as strong. He'll need to use a scooter to get around for long distances, to get around campus. I think that made a huge impact because kids understood what was going on, and they were able to understand through their parents how to interact with me and just how to treat me normally. And I think that helped a lot. But again, it was great that, you know, I wasn't reliant on a chair like all the time. Like, basically, I can still walk a little bit, but not very much. And when I'm like outside of the apartment in like unfamiliar territory, like, my wheelchair is kind of my safety. Not if that makes sense, but
yeah.
I would say that the perspective of having grown up without being super reliant on it's been good and bad, because like, I know what I'm missing out on, but I also was able to experience that. So I actually didn't get my first chair until I would say my freshman year of college.
Okay.
And that didn't mean I was, because before then I had that scooter, like I said, you know, it's like a four-wheeled scooter with like a seat and handlebars kind of thing. And I used that for a while, and obviously got more and more reliant on that to cover distance that I couldn't walk as far and hurt my muscles. And so I've been using that, and obviously it's not the best setup if you're going to be sitting in there for most of your day. So that's when we ended up deciding that we need to get the power wheelchair. And I got that again my freshman year of college, and that made life a lot easier. And also the fact that it elevated, that was huge for me, because I could still be independent, because if I get my chair up high enough, I could stand up on my own without having to like strain to get out of a normal chair or something like that. So it was really great for me. It was, the scooter doesn't seem as intimidating as like a power chair is. And I think that was maybe the struggle, is people probably think your disease is more extreme, I guess, if you're in a power wheelchair, because people have this, you know, preconceived notion in their head, like, oh, that, like, that equals bad. And so I think I just had to get over that internal being self-conscious about, I think the hardest part for me was using my chair and then being able to get out of it and like walk to get my computer out of my bag or something like that. And I was always worried people would be like, well, does he need this? Like, why does he need this chair if he's able to walk? And so that was kind of always in my head. And my dad really inspired me just to not care about what other people think, just do you, and they can think whatever they want and it's not going to impact you. And so now it's not a problem at all.
It's interesting you say that too, because that's one of the things that I've learned working for BioNews is, you know, I've always had a very visible disability, but you and I both work with a ton of people who have very invisible ones. And so you, and I think they have to deal with that a lot. Like, it's something I've never really had to deal with, because like I said, I'm very dependent on other people, always have been, for physical needs. And so, but you know, we have coworkers with cystic fibrosis and pulmonary hypertension and all these different conditions where they have that stigma more associated with them. And it is a really interesting thing to navigate. And, but I think it's important also to just kind of ignore people's, like, they're going to think what they think and you're going to have to deal with it. But one thing on that note though, is when you started college, did you work with the Disability Services Office at all for accommodations, or were you still kind of just independent on in that regard?
I did work with them only in the case that they allowed me to have what would have been a double room and turn into a single. Like, they gave me a double room, but only for me, so I could have my, because I still have my scooter and I still have my chair at that time. So like I could have that and then my stretching table as well, so I could get physical therapy. That was the main thing that they helped me with. And in the same suite, it was divided in rooms, but each room was like a suite. There were like a few rooms that shared one bathroom. And so shared two bathrooms. And one of my friends since kindergarten got into USC as well. And so he was in the room next to me, basically. So it was nice to have someone who knew what my situation was. And
yeah,
you know, we had fire alarms. He would piggyback me down the stairs once. And then I figured out the elevator still worked during the fire alarm. So I just went down the elevator, and that was a very annoying process, but it was good to have someone there who could, you know, like help clean my room, help me with laundry, et cetera, those physical things. And, you know, I think I can do most physical things with the exception of cooking, like getting out of chairs, showering, but pretty much everything else I can do on my own. And so we could talk about that later, but that's another thing. It's like the transition between what you can and can't do, and then how you figure that out. But now I've lost track. What was your question?
No, that's actually a really good point. I think let's talk about that more in just a minute. Before we do, if everyone could please listen to one more brief word from our sponsor.
This podcast is made possible by a sponsorship from Genentech. Are you living with SMA, or are you a caregiver for someone who is? A treatment has been FDA approved based on studies of different types of people living with SMA. Genentech extends a special thanks to all the individuals, families, and healthcare providers who participated in the studies that led to making this treatment option a reality. To learn more about this treatment, visit approvedforsma.com.
Yeah, no, Hawken, that's actually a really great transition. As I'm curious, as you know, as your disability progressed, and you know, we talked about the chair, but also, like you just said, learning to accept what you can do and what you can't. Obviously, you still stuck with the same career, But can you talk about how that impacted it? And like, you know, did I know you and I now work from home, but like when you were doing internships and interviews and all that stuff, what kind of things did you have to do to make sure that we're still within your capabilities? Did you have to have any accommodations, interviews, you know, anything like that you want to talk about?
I mainly had for accommodations the use of a computer for essays and then extra time on tests and such. And that was helpful for me, less stressful and preserving again my hand strength, et cetera, my wrist strength. And then as far as journalism, I was pretty much able to do everything they asked without accommodations. And I probably could have asked for some, but, you know, one example is they would, you know, cut up the textbooks and make them digital. And for me, I already like would get the Kindle ebook version, or I would just, you know, have one textbook or have two textbooks, one in each place. And so I didn't have to lug them around. I did that for high school to have, you know, two sets of one book. So I didn't have to lug it around. So there's that. And then surprisingly it worked that I was still able to do pretty much everything that they asked of me in journalism school that now I probably wouldn't have been able to do just because of the progression. So one example is doing TV packages. That's something that's pretty difficult because you have to be in charge of yourself and a camera. And I actually did, you know how they do stand-ups in TV. So I actually would get on my chair, like set up the camera, do a stand-up. And that was probably not the smartest way to go because I could have fallen and been stuck there or something like that. And but I still did it. And that was, you know, through my sophomore year. And then as I got more into text journalism, it doesn't really matter too much. The only struggle is that some places that you have to go to do your story aren't exactly the most accessible. Like, for example, one of the first esports and video game stories I did for the Washington Post was about a pop-up bar that was like Super Mario, Super Smash Brothers inspired pop-up bar. And so I went to interview people and they were still constructing the pop-up bar. So like I had to finagle my wheelchair into the door and like through like dust and paint and all that to get the interview done. But generally places are pretty accessible and generally people are pretty understanding of my situation, but it is also frustrating at the same time because I want to do my job, but this is like getting in the way of it and things being inaccessible are getting in the way of it. But with working from home, like you said, most of my interviews have been remote anyway. And so I've been able to balance that pretty well. And yeah, so it ended up working out. And again, not doing any video stuff because that's pretty intense. And that definitely slowed down. I actually did do like my senior year, started doing this show where I talked to video game developers and played their games at the same time. And so one of the people that I interviewed was a USC student who developed a VR game. And so I basically set up my phone, my camera, and my GoPro. And so I had like a 3-camera setup and had to deal with that. And that was probably the last kind of video thing I did. But now with an iPhone, it's a lot easier to capture things that you need to capture. But, you know, even local news reporters have been using phones and stuff, and it ends up working out okay on TV. But I basically transitioned into writing because I liked it, but also because the video stuff was becoming a little bit difficult to do.
Oh, it's a lot from doing not just the production and shooting, but editing and all that side of it. But it's, you know, so you're talking about video game journalism and that kind of thing you were doing in college. And you and I kind of like similar journeys in that regard, in that when I was in college, I was working with a school paper and I mainly did arts and entertainment journalism. I did more the movies and comics kind of side of things, mm-hmm. writing movie reviews and interviewing local filmmakers and artists and that kind of thing. And then, you know, I eventually transitioned into writing about my disability and then, you know, wound up here eventually. But what was that journey like for you in terms of, I know from reading your columns, you wanted to be a video game journalist and then, but what was it, what kind of compelled you to start writing about your life with Duchenne and then how that evolved into your job now at BioNews?
Yeah. It's I feel like both things happened simultaneously. I was doing video game journalism and then I was writing about my disease and I decided to go down one track and I can talk about that. But, you know, I also haven't stopped doing video game stuff and I can also talk about that. But rewinding a bit, my senior capstone project at USC was about Twitch, and you know, Twitch has these big streamers, but I was really looking at the smaller, I call them micro communities on Twitch, you know, a handful of people watching, and you know, the small time streamers and the community they were able to build there. And so actually went to UCI, which was one of the first schools to have an esports program, and I interviewed the director there, and that was a really cool experience. That was one of the last video things that I did, and I talked to the director. They had their own Twitch channel, and you know, I talked to some students who were helping build that. And so with all that goodbye, I was like, you know, I can actually write about this kind of stuff. And the funny thing is, around that same time, you know, I was reading the Washington Post, and there was a writer there who had been doing video games, and I was following him, and he actually did a story about how video game photography, taking photos like within video games for the Spider-Man game, because their engine for capturing in-game photos is really expansive. And so he wrote an article about, you know, a subreddit that was devoted to that and the people who were taking photos and such. And so I saw that article and was really interested in it and ended up getting an internship with the Washington Post. And I ended up meeting Teddy, who wrote the piece. And then for the Overwatch Grand Finals in 2019, we both went to the Wells Fargo Arena in Philadelphia and covered that. So wow. It was really cool to read that and then be working with one of the people who, he was an audience editor, but he had an interest in video games. And so he wrote about that. And so I was able to report with him, and that was really a cool experience. And so esports is just rapidly growing. There's a lot of opportunity. The fans are super hyped about it. Even just watching the grand finals in 2019, yeah. Now we're 2 years later and it's even more. And I went to BlizzCon that same year and had that whole experience. And so that kind of, you know, piqued my interest in video games, and did freelance for a bit while I was writing for BioNews. And so actually going back to writing about my disease, I had a friend in my Christian club who said, oh, I have a friend from Hawaii, Brad, and he's looking for columnists. And I connected with him and he said, yeah, you know, you should, you know, write your column. Like, we'd like to hear your story. And up until that point, I hadn't really written about myself too much. And so that was an experience, but I think I'm glad I had that opportunity, because I don't know if I would have otherwise. And I think writing is very therapeutic, as you know, and getting out your thoughts and feelings on paper and also being able to help other people at the same time is really empowering. So it took me a while to realize that, you know, I wrote my column, you know, every week. Now I do it biweekly because I have a full-time job now, but with BioNews, of course. And so that's how I got plugged in with BioNews. And then Larry Luxner, who worked for us as a journalist, he did a story about me. I met him at one of my parents have a foundation called Cure Duchenne that, you know, devotes fundraising to Duchenne research and also care and physical therapy, et cetera. And so he was covering one of our conferences. I met him, talked about my journalism. And when I got back from the Washington Post, talked to him again, he connected me. Chris was there. Chris Cormish was there, CEO, and met him. And it was December after I got back from the Washington Post that I got hired. Then unfortunately COVID happened. They couldn't keep me on, but I still did freelance throughout that. Also did esports freelancing and still do sometimes. And have been doing that, writing featured articles, you know, for BioNews. And then finally, as things started picking up, I was able to come back on again just in April. And so I've been writing feature stories on a full-time basis since then. And that's it. I really enjoy being able to focus on a certain, we call it beats in journalism. Like, they have a police beat, they have a, you know, like you said, arts and entertainment. And so, you know, the rare disease beat, so to speak, has been great because I've been able to build connections there and find common ground. And, you know, some of the difficult part about it is just being objective when I can empathize with a lot of these people. And so, but it's also important because I can ask them the right questions and know what they're going through and can uncover that in my reporting. So it's been really cool to just be able to focus on one aspect, and one that I think is so impactful to people. Obviously, you know, esports can be that way, certainly, but I feel like this is definitely more impactful than that. And I'm still, you know, producing a show for Call of Duty about the Call of Duty League. Okay. And so I'm a research producer there. And so I'm still got my foot in the door there while I'm simultaneously working at Bounties, obviously, is my priority. And some of the stories I've read and some of the feedback I've gotten has really like anchored the fact that, yes, this is something that I like to do. And this is something that is making an impact.
That's really cool. No, I love a couple of things you said there, like going back to your column first. It's, again, it was similar with me too. I was so used to writing about other people or writing about arts and entertainment and doing fiction and stuff as well. And then it was an experience writing about my own story and sharing it. And then after a while, I got so comfortable with that. It just became my primary and I love doing it. And the other thing too, I love what you said about, you know, writing feature stories for BioNews, again, about all these different disease communities. It is so important to have someone with your perspective doing that, because like you said, you know the right questions to ask. Because I think that's a lot of times why there is a limited amount of media representation for people with disabilities, is a lot of people who don't, you know, walk in our shoes, but like live in our world, you know, they don't know the kind of questions to ask. And because of that, you can see a difference in the stories. And so I think that's a great point. And something I wanted to ask you on there is thinking about SMA specifically. You know, you've written a number of stories about SMA, and, you know, I know, of course, some of your stories go to multiple websites, but thinking about the stories you've done on SMA individuals and families, and what are some of the things you've learned about SMA in the community, and maybe ways that it does or doesn't compare to Duchenne?
Yeah, I think what pops into my head most is I covered a webinar. I can't remember who did it, but a mother of someone of a boy with SMA, uh-huh. I believe it's type 2, was one of the first to receive Zolgensma when it was approved. Got it when he was, you know, just an infant, like a couple days old. And now he's like running around, like, you know, jumping, you know, on a trampoline and going to preschool, kindergarten, perfectly fine. And so that I learned, like a cure is possible. Like, I think that's something that really stuck out to me, that what we're working for, like, as far as advocacy, is actually coming to fruition. And I think I see a similar thing with Duchenne. Like, there's a lot of science going on, and I think SMA, the breakthroughs with, you know, Spinraza and Zolgensma, I think those things are good for everyone, because we're able to learn how that disease applies to Duchenne, for example, and, you know, delivering the correct gene to the body. And so that was really interesting to me. I think as far as similarities and differences, I think there is similarities between how the disease manifests. Obviously, most people with Duchenne are pretty much confined to a wheelchair in their teens, and, you know, most people with SMA, it's even earlier. But again, like in the middle of life, we're both in a wheelchair, right? And we have that shared experience and limited mobility. And I guess to other people in the world, it looks similar, even though it's not. And so again, like, obviously SMA is a bit more, both diseases are bad, obviously, but I think SMA presents at an earlier age and more aggressively, from what I understand. And so I'd say that's a difference. But even with SMA compared to other diseases as well, it's the people that I think really are the same. Like, we're all humans, we're all here in this together. And I think no matter what our physical disability is, we still have wants, we still have needs, we still have, you know, personality, we still have all these things. And I think it's easy to overlook that and just focus on, oh, he's in a wheelchair and like can't do anything for himself, et cetera. And I think slowly but surely that conversation is changing, and they're looking at people with disabilities as people too, and not some like other species or something like that. And I think that's been really encouraging, and, you know, trying to show that this, we're all disabled, but we all have personalities, we're all different. But at the same time, we all share the same DNA, mostly just a couple errors, and it changes how it manifests. So we're all people, and we all have needs and wants and desires, and they should be respected.
I think that's great. Absolutely. And it's Yeah, no, I mean, speaking as a member of the SMA community for a long time, I thought you said there about it's really the people that comes to define, and just that even we have like differences, that universal element of just being human and finding connections both in shared struggles and just shared experiences in general, it makes a huge impact. And well, Håkon, thank you so much for coming on today. And one last question I had for you is just, and this is something I ask a lot of people come on here, is what does a typical day look like for you? And obviously I know this question comes with the with COVID in mind too. So I guess thinking with the, if you can put that aside too, like thinking about but just what does a typical day look like for you, working, managing your care, anything that about and social life, any of those elements you want to talk about?
Yeah, it's funny because like the past couple of years have been anything but typical of my life, because I've been at the, Sacramento Bee, been in Washington, D.C. But now, like, I've been home for what, like, it's October 2019. So
Two years.
almost 2 years.
Yeah.
Almost 2 years, minus 5 months. But yeah, so now I've kind of been getting into a routine, and I'm vaccinated now, so I've been able to get out more. So I think actually this is a perfect time to ask the question, because now I'm kind of getting into a more defined routine in my life. But yeah, I usually get up between 7 to 10 a.m. It really depends on how tired I am, because I am more prone to get tired during work, during work days at the end of the day. So sleep is very holy to me, so I try to get as much of it as possible. And I actually wear a BiPAP at night. It's funny, I read your column about your Darth Vader mask, and I with your BiPAP, and I have been struggling with that for like 5 years, not wearing it because it's uncomfortable. I hated it. A lot of my friends were like, they can't even take it off, so like they're forced to wear it. And my problem is like, I just take it off because it's uncomfortable and I want to go to sleep. And that, and just my parents constantly hounding me about it, I've finally been able to like start wearing that more consistently and for longer. So that's been helpful. And so that's my morning routine. So my parents will help me cook breakfast to like help me shower. But basically all I need help with is like getting out of the shower chair. So like I get in, like do my shower, and then they help me out. And so that's how that works. And then, the rest of the day I'm working on interviewing people or writing, or doing some meetings for this Call of Duty thing. And so then at the end of the day, I usually just, eat dinner, and sometimes, get a little bit of video gaming in at night. But usually during the week, I've been trying to not do that as much, just because I'm so tired. I want to save all my energy for what I do professionally. And so that's during the week. And during the weekend, I've been able to go to church now. I've been able to go to my Bible study and, interact with more of my friends, do some Dungeons and Dragons. Yeah, that's a little bit about my routine these days.
That's really cool. And yeah, as far as my BiPAP Vader mask column, I know it ended up like when I go on the sites, it still shows up there. So it's funny how that one became like I think it's become one of my most. But yeah, it's funny because I've gotten really used to it. I mean, I've worn it for so long, and it's I think like I talked about in that column, they've gotten a lot better over the years. When I was a kid, they were like full Vader mask, and it was a pain in the butt, and I'd always wake up with sores and stuff. These days with the nose piece, I mean. I totally relate to that. Like, it does get uncomfortable, and sometimes I just want to take it off, but I've gotten a lot more used to it. But it's more in the morning when you wake up and you take it off after you've had it on all night, and then you start, it's like, it's like, it's almost like ripping a Band-Aid off, It's that,
Yeah,
but it does help
definitely.
me. So it's, I know, I think that's something a lot like people in the SMA and MD communities can relate to,
Yeah, it helps, but it's not fun. And
Yeah.
I've been great about wearing my night splints at night, doing all the things I'm supposed to do, but this one has been a challenge. And so it's a psychological battle. It's like you have to get through like wanting to take it off, and then you eventually fall asleep and it's fine, but you got to get through that psychological battle.
Right. It is. Oh, I understand that version, especially when you start it later. I mean, it's a transition, but yeah. Well, Hagen, thank you so much. I think this is a great conversation. And before we go, where can people find you? I know you have your column, but anywhere else?
Yeah, I think so. I'll post some of my work on LinkedIn. It's just Hawken Miller. I'll also post it on Twitter at Hawken Miller. Pretty simple. And yeah, those are the best places to find me. I also stream on Twitch. It's The Hawk Live, no spaces. Each letter is capitalized, so The Hawk Live. And yeah, those are the three main places that I do stuff.
Awesome. And we'll put a link to your column in the description. But well, Hawken, thank you again so much for coming on today.
Yeah.
And for our listeners out there, like I said, you can find many of Hawken's stories on SMA News Today, and then also his column on MD News Today, our sibling site. So,
Thanks,
Hawken,
Kevin. This is fun.
Oh, thank you. This was great. And to our listeners out there, thank you so much for joining us today, and we will see you next time. Take care, everyone.
The information in our flash briefings and podcasts are provided for informational and educational purposes only. Be sure to tune in daily to SMA News Today for the latest news and perspectives regarding the disease. Discover more content that might be of interest to you at www.smanewstoday.com, and be sure to follow us on social media and join our SMA News Today forums, a trusted SMA community ready to welcome you anytime.